Studio 360.
A century and a half ago, Charles Darwin published On the Origin of Species. At the time, his ideas really rocked the world. You know the basic theory. Over the course of many, many generations, all living creatures evolve and adapt physically and mentally by means of chance mutations. And he or she who reproduces the most wins. With such truly radical ideas, it helped that Charles Darwin was one of the most terrific science writers ever. Long before he published the theory of evolution, he'd become famous for the journal that he kept during the voyage of the Beagle.
When the condors are wheeling in a flock, round and round any spot, their flight is beautiful. I watched several for nearly half an hour without once taking off my eyes. They moved in large curves, sweeping in circles, descending and ascending without giving a single flap.
So on the one hand, he was trying to write very, very accurately, get exactly the colour of each sort of specimen he was looking at. And on the other hand, he was trying to write vividly and to express and convey his own enthusiasm for what he was seeing and thinking.
That is Ruth Padell. She's a poet and a professor of poetry at Oxford University. And she is also Charles Darwin's great-great-granddaughter. In 2009, she published a biography of her famous ancestor, all in verse. It's called Darwin, A Life in Poems. So as you were growing up, And in your family, is being a descendant of Charles Darwin a big deal?
When I look back, it was just a fact, you know. It wasn't a big deal. I didn't know who he was really. I mean, I knew Dr. Doolittle. Do you have Dr. Doolittle?
Yes, we do.
Yeah, I used to love those books. And, you know, my grandmother, she was the person who really started Darwin scholarship. She edited his the journals he kept on the Beagle.
This is Nora Barlow.
That's right, yes.
Uh-huh.
And Charles Darwin was kind of part of the house that I loved, the big garden, the dogs, the flowers, the rooms, the books.
So as a young girl, you got this child's cozy, lovely sense of Darwin. And when you think about it, what he did was, compared to what most respectable gentlemen did, a kind of child's pursuit.
That's right. He had this sense of wonder. I mean, Darwin and Emma, Charles Darwin and Emma, his wife, they, you know, the children ran in and out. He would string them out across the meadow and get them to, you know, to join in his experiments, like trying to paint the bumblebees with little bits of white sort of flowery liquid. And he was always looking at all life forms, you know, whether they were ants or children or bees, and thinking, how does it feel to be like that? I wonder if.
In addition to being like something a child would imagine, it also seems like something that would derive from the soul of an artist, imagining ways in which the world could be connected that are not conventional.
Yes, that's absolutely true. And I responded to that very much when I was working on these poems. Mm-hmm. When he was on the Beagle, the one book he took in his pocket always for land expeditions was Milton's Paradise Lost. He loved Wordsworth. You know, one of his favorite lines of Wordsworth was, "Nature never will betray the heart that loves her." But as he got older, he felt rather sad at the end of his life that he said, if I'd had my life over again, I would have made it a rule to read a poem every day.
Well, there you go. Now, well, I guess that somehow made its way into you. You write a poem that, indeed, I found very moving, called Plankton, and I'd love it if you could read that for us.
Sure. No, I'm glad you like that one. It's when he's just getting his sea legs in December 1831. And here he is in January 1832, and he's been terribly sick, seasick. He's been lying on the floor moaning. And suddenly the sea calms. They're in the North Atlantic, and he's really discovering, naturalizing with properly equipped things for the first time. And he is entranced. Plankton. The deck is dazzle. Fish stink. Gauze-covered buckets. Gelatinous ingots. Rainbows of wet flinching amethyst and flubbed iridescent cream. All this means he's better and working on a haul of lumpen light. Polyps, plankton, jellyfish. Sea butterflies, the pteropods. So low in the scale of nature, so exquisite in their forms. You wonder at so much beauty, created apparently for such little purpose. They lower his creel to blue pores of subtropical ocean. Wave flicker, white as a gun flash, over the blown heart of sapphire. Peacock eyes, beaten and swollen, tossing on lazuline steel.
Ruth Bedell reading Plankton from her book Darwin, A Life in Poems. When did you first decide you wanted to write a poem about Charles Darwin?
Well, it came in different stages. I remember once looking after my grandmother, Nora, towards the end of her life in Cambridge. It was a very rainy summer, and she was talking to me about Charles and Emma's relationship, which had to negotiate this increasing gulf in their religious attitudes.
On the basis of what Charles was discovering and what she could not accommodate.
Yes, she knew his ideas. He discussed them with her. But in the 19th century, there was so much death around that Christianity was very, very much based on the afterlife. And, you know, it was felt at this time, and Emma shared this view, that if you didn't believe in Christian revelation, you would go to hell. And so if there was a husband and wife and one of them believed and one of them didn't, they wouldn't be together in eternity. And I thought, my goodness, I'd like to write about that.
Do you think Darwin's ideas get sort of misused in public currency?
When he was working, when he saw as a young man, not quite 30, that natural selection would be the mechanism for the ways species had evolved, he kept it to himself because he knew that it would be anathema unless he could prove it. And the thing that was radical was the idea that a living species changed. It was a great breakthrough, but he didn't actually tell it to even his closest friend, John Hooker, the botanist at Kew Gardens, until 1844. And then he just said, it's very revolutionary. It is like confessing to a murder, he said.
Hmm. I presume you, rather than simply relying on family lore, spent a lot of time reading Darwin's letters and notes and papers as you were preparing to write these works. Was there a single sort of surprise about Charles Darwin that you came across?
I think it was the humor, the humor and the warmth. And once you're with him, you just sort of want to smile at what he's saying. But then there was also the emotional passages when he, with a great, great loss of his life, aside from his mother when he was 8, was their 10-year-old daughter, Annie, when she was 10. And the other thing I ought to perhaps explain is that the more he worked, the more he did experiments, the more he realized about breeding, that sexual selection was so crucial because there were two different parents, not from the same stock, but he had married his own first cousin. Mm-hmm. So maybe he was responsible for Annie's death. That was the iron in his soul after she died.
Really? I never knew that. He wondered that he had not sufficiently hybridized.
Yes. He was terrified of that. And he was terrified of the other children. He was always looking out for illness in the other children. He felt it was his fault.
Hmm. Do you have a favorite poem from the book?
I have favourite passages of poems. I really am very fond of Emma's letter that she writes to him after he has told her about his religious doubts. But it's quite a long one.
Could you read some of it?
I'll read some of it, yeah.
Great.
It's called A Path Around a Lake. It's from December 1838. She's thinking about what he said. It is foolish, perhaps, but now we belong, my own dear Charlie, to each other. I cannot help being open with you. Melancholy thoughts keep generally out of my head, but since you are gone, some sad ones have forced themselves in. I know we feel the same about right and wrong, but our opinions on the most important thing are very different. Your faith should stand in the power of God, not the wisdom of man. My reason says honest, conscientious doubt cannot be a sin, but it would be a painful void. Religion is an affair of the heart, not the intellect. This is a whim of mine. If you would read Our Saviour's Farewell to His Disciples, the part of the New Testament I love best. She looks at the sandy path where they used to run as children round the lake. He'll read the thing, never doubt it. Then, though I can hardly tell why, I don't wish you to give me your opinion about it.
That's Ruth Bedell reading part of A Path Around a Lake from her book Darwin, A Life in Poems. Ben Knox Miller plays in a band called The Low Anthem, and a few years ago, they made a record called Oh My God, Charlie Darwin.
The name for a record occurred to us outside the giraffe's pen at the Roger Williams Zoo. And after that name for the record was said out loud, it kind of became clear that there was this undercurrent to a bunch of the songs that we've been writing that came somewhat from Darwinism and from our fascination with the survival of the fittest, of ideas, and that our values are evolved by the same kind of competition that our genes are passed on.
Life is cold and formless. Oh my God, it's all around.
That's Ben Knox Miller from the band Low Anthem. Their new record, Island, is out right now. Coming up, a fossil hunter tries to reconcile Darwin's science with his personal beliefs.
I think God started the whole shooting match, and he uses the mechanisms of natural selection and evolution to guide life on Earth and life in the universe.
We'll put evolution to the test. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
So, how do you think that humans came to be?
Well, I can sum it up very quickly. I accept evolution, but with a supreme being at the hand and eye behind everything that has ever happened to us.
Here in Studio 360 today, we're talking about evolution.
It's very complex. It's really hard for me to say, but I don't think we could ever, like, say absolutely how we got here, you know what I mean?
My next guest, Spencer Wells, begs to disagree. He absolutely thinks we can say how we got here. He is an evolutionary biologist and was explorer in residence at the National Geographic Society until last year. He headed up a major research effort called the Genographic Project. For a decade, Wells traveled around the planet gathering bits of DNA from all sorts of far-flung human populations in order to map out genetic genealogy on a global scale. It's called biohistory.
I started off actually being a little more interested in history than in science. I remember standing in line in New Orleans, Louisiana, back in, I think it was 1977, maybe 78, to see the King Tut exhibit the first time it toured. And, you know, we were outside in the rain waiting for 12 hours to get in. We finally got the tickets and went in, and it was amazing. It blew me away. It was like these things could have been created the day before, but they were about 3,500 years old. And I decided then and there, I'm going to study history. I'm going to study deep history, archaeology. And it wasn't until a little bit later on that I started hanging out in a scientific laboratory and discovered what genetics was all about and that it's kind of cool. And that, it, you know, again, it's like reading a code. It's like, you know, discovering something that you didn't know was going to be there. It's like archaeology, but with a twist. And, you know, ended up a few years later deciding that I wanted to combine the two, using genetics as a tool to study these ancient historical events.
For the last few years, you have been traveling the world in charge of the Genographic Project for National Geographic. In that project, what are the main questions you're trying to answer?
Well, it's really, you know, a concerted scientific effort to make sense of a very basic human question. You know, where do we all come from? We look around, we see people who seem to be so different from each other and from ourselves. You know, do we share a common origin? And if we do spring from a common source, how did we populate every corner of the globe? You know, think about going back in time to the age of exploration, the European age of exploration, and you're setting sail with Captain Cook or someone like that, and you wash ashore in some distant Pacific island, and the first thing you see are other people. You know, it's kind of surprising. I mean, it wasn't surprising for them, but, you know, it should be surprising for us because the question is, how did they get there and when did they get there? So we're really trying to answer those key questions and in the process try to understand how we generated the patterns of human diversity that we see today.
Now, when you go off, as I presume you do around the world, collecting DNA from indigenous populations, what's a typical day look like?
It really depends on where we're going. I mean, we've done some expeditions to places like Tajikistan and Chad, North Central Africa, up to the Tibesti Mountains, the first expedition that had gone in there in 40 years or so because of all the fighting that's gone on with Libya and with rebel groups in the country. So almost uniformly, when we do get to these places, people are fascinated by this notion that they're carrying a piece of their history, a piece of their ancestors inside of them, and that we're going to help them unlock the secrets, tell them something about their distant past that they never suspected.
And so when once you start swabbing out bits of their DNA, they already have some basic idea of what it is you're doing?
Yeah. I mean, they may not understand the details of A, C, G, and T and what the double helix looks
like. Me neither.
But they have a very clear sense of being connected to their ancestors. And, you know, in many cases, Kazakhstan's a great example. They have to be able to name their male ancestors, at least, going back seven generations or so. That helps to define who they are and the clan they belong to and who they can marry. And it takes us back through all the generations you can name and then back beyond that and shows how you're connected to people over in Botswana or in Cambodia and to me. And their eyes light up and they say, wow, that's so cool.
What are some specific examples of discoveries about who's lived where, when, and when they moved this place at what date that you've made so far?
Well, I think one of the most exciting ones was we originate in the fossil record in Africa about 200,000 years ago at Omokabish in Ethiopia. And according to the genetic data, and now as we start to analyze it more carefully, the archaeological data, we don't start to leave Africa, modern humans, until around 50 to 60,000 years ago. So we spent three quarters of our history as a species living only in Africa. And people have kind of assumed, yes, that's the case. Africa's the source and things got interesting once we started to leave. But they kind of ignored what might have been going on in Africa prior to people leaving. And in fact, there was a lot going on. It's theoretically possible that there could have been two species of humanity walking around if that process had continued, that divergence. But, you know, you look back in the hominid line and we've learned, you know, more and more over the last 10 to 20 years that it's really a bush. It's not a straight lineage down to us in the present day. There are all these different species being tried out at various points in time and then they go extinct.
And is it shifting what we think we know about the nature of evolution?
It has. Look back to around 70,000 years ago, our species was on the brink of extinction, and there were no more than a couple of thousand people alive at that time.
Really?
Only in Africa, yeah. And so we've spread around the world in the process, generated that diversity relatively quickly. You know, that's a couple of thousand human generations. And, of course, what has governed the generation of that diversity are all of Darwin's evolutionary forces. So we've got natural selection adapting to different climatic regimes as we leave the tropics and move into higher latitudes. We've got Darwin's famous force of sexual selection, which probably has played a big role. People mating with individuals they find attractive, and that's going to vary according to where you are in the world. And then, of course, a force that Darwin didn't know about, but we know about as geneticists, random genetic drift. You know, changes in gene frequency that occur simply because these are small populations splitting apart, and it's a sampling error. It's like flipping a coin 10 times versus 1,000. You may not get exactly 50-50. And so all of these forces have contributed to the diversity we see.
Does it seem that Darwin was seriously wrong about anything other than just incomplete?
He didn't understand genetics, unfortunately. Evolution is a genetic phenomenon. At its most basic level, evolution is a change in gene frequency over time. And Darwin came up with this very complicated theory toward the end when he was doing revision upon revision of the origin of species, where he had this idea of blending genetic variation, where you would have some of the genes from one of the parents and some of the genes from the other, and the children would end up in the middle. And so you would lose variation in every generation. And of course, variation underlies natural selection. You have to have variation for selection to act. And so Darwin didn't really get the disconnect there because he didn't understand genetics. And in fact, apparently Mendel had sent him a copy of his manuscript, the famous study on peas, where he described, you know, the big A and the little a and how these fit together in the Punnett square that we all learn about in our genetics courses. And Darwin didn't read it and didn't really understand it. So, yeah, I think he was wrong about genetics, but he was right in almost every other way.
Yeah. When I was growing up in the Midwest in the 60s and 70s, I literally never heard any suggestion that evolution wasn't true. You know, Inherit the Wind was, you know, performed, and that was, oh, in the bad old days, that's what those stupid people believed. As you were growing up, was evolution a settled debate, or are you young enough that it was being challenged?
I really don't remember it being debated. I got to tell you, I pretty much have the same memory that you do. I mean, I grew up in the Bible Belt in West Texas, admittedly in an academic family, but still, you know, going to high school, it was always a given that you were going to learn about evolution, natural selection in your biology classes. And what's shocking to me is that the acceptance of evolution in the United States has actually dropped over the last generation. And the number of people who doubt evolution has gone up from like 10% to 25%. And there was a survey that was done recently where they looked at a lot of developed countries. And in terms of acceptance of evolution, the U.S. was second to last, right above Turkey.
If you could say there's one thing that people today ought to know about evolution, what is that one thing?
I would quote Theodosius Dobzhansky, a very well-known evolutionary geneticist, who said, "Nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution." You know, you look at any biological system and it does not make sense unless you consider its evolutionary history. We are not optimized machines. We're not globally optimized. What we have done is tinkered with what we've been given by our ancestors and produced the best set of characteristics that we can given those constraints. But those characteristics only make sense if you think about the evolutionary history of how they got there.
Because if there were, let's say, an intelligent designer, presumably he or she would have gotten it right the first time rather than have this kind of kludgy, complicated, Rube Goldberg-y set of systems that we inhabit.
Exactly. Our esophagus and our trachea wouldn't share the same opening, and we'd never have to worry about choking to death on food.
Yeah. Good point. Spencer Wells, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Spencer Wells directed the Genographic Project for National Geographic until 2015, and he is the author of Pandora's Seed, The Unforeseen Cost of Civilization.
How do you think it all began?
I think God created the world in one day, just the way the Bible says. As far as I'm concerned, it's for the atheists to prove otherwise, and they haven't been able to do it, not even any way, shape, or form, not even close.
I'm in the Darwinian school of evolution, and I believe that it took a very, very long time for us to get where we are today.
More voices from the streets of New York City, and for we in the Darwinian school, how do we know exactly how long it's taken to get where we are? From the fossil record. Biologists since Darwin have been collecting hard physical evidence of how one species evolves to the next and the next over eons. And people are still digging up and working on that record. John Halsey has no credentials or formal training in paleontology, but he has amassed, nevertheless, a remarkable fossil collection, and he has some ambitious plans for it. Reporter Lindsay Patterson went to check it out.
A few months ago, I happened to be talking about dinosaurs with a man named John Halsey, and he mentioned that he had found a mosasaur. The mosasaur is an ancient, gigantic marine lizard. It's the length of a small bus, with a massive skull and a powerful jaw. It lived alongside the dinosaurs. I could hardly believe it. A mosasaur is a pretty incredible find.
Oh, wow.
Okay. You might want to kneel down. See, this is a leg bone that is still embedded in the rock, and see these vertebrae right here and the ribs? I'm still in the process of chipping these out.
John Halsey lives in Irving, Texas, near Dallas. When he isn't digging fossils, he drives a truck. He has the mosasaur stored in a crawl space under the house. Fragments of the delicate skeleton are encased in these 200-pound chunks of rock.
How did you find these? How did you recognize them as fossils?
Well, I was walking in a creek bottom a few years ago in Dallas, which was an outcrop of the Eagle Ford Shale. I looked down, and there was a piece of this boulder that had fallen down from the ledge up above, and it had what looked like three vertebrae embedded in it. So I said, "Holy mackerel." And I also uttered some other expletives, too.
John didn't report his find to any authorities. The way he sees it, museums have enough old bones already. So John wants the Mosasaur in his own museum, which is currently housed in his garage. It's called the American Museum of God. John has actually registered this name with the city. He spent most of his adult life building its collection.
Did y'all bring a ball cap?
For 45 years, he's gone to a site on the North Sulphur River in East Texas, about an hour and a half away.
How about the knee pads? Because that's very crucial. Be close to the ground.
His stepson Yoshifumi and some kids from his church are coming along, and John's sister Isabel, who's a science teacher.
My grandmother, who lived with us, we'd be sitting there with the TV on, and what would really get her incensed was the Three Stooges.
She would say, "This is rotting your minds."
And then my father would come in and turn off the TV, and he would say, "Do something constructive." In fact, we put that on his tombstone. Do something constructive.
That's right.
Even today, I can't really relax and kick back because I feel I should be doing something constructive.
John and Isabel grew up Catholic. Now John belongs to the Universal Peace Federation, a church based in South Korea. He can get a little sarcastic about fundamentalists who take the biblical Genesis literally.
Because even in the Bible, it says in Genesis, a day is as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is as a day. So, you know, why was God in such a rush to create the universe in 7 days? Did he have a deadline to meet? No.
Do you think that God plays a role in evolution now?
I think God started the whole shooting match, and he uses the mechanisms of natural selection and evolution to guide life on Earth and life in the universe.
This is more or less the intelligent design position. Life is just too complex to be only the product of Darwinian evolution, so a higher power must be involved.
We've been so busy talking that we haven't passed Greenville.
At a pit stop, John takes out some old carpet, which he cuts into squares and duct tapes tightly around our knees. He tapes it so tight, I can't bend my knees to get back into the car.
Here's the trick in finding treasure in the Sulphur River. You have to put everything out of your mind. I've had many instances where I was preoccupied with something on my mind and I wouldn't find anything. But if you're excited about finding sharks' teeth and fossils and you're focused on it, then you will find them. And you'll come back again and again and again. Amen.
During the Upper Cretaceous period, the region was covered by ocean, so there are remains of sharks and marine reptiles like John's Mosasaur. More recently, from the Pleistocene era, you might find mammoth and bison bones, but I remind myself that finding a dinosaur is very, very rare.
This is the North Sulphur River.
Look, it is.
Oh, it's in perfect shape.
Ooh. And here we go.
We're going to find some treasure, folks.
Well, with all this lead up, I mean, the whole way.
Everybody get a pair of gloves. And we're going to go down this embankment here, walk along the riverbank, and then cross over. You may get your feet wet. And we're going to wind up where the gray shale is exposed.
So it makes one area better than others.
Well, slightly raised, gravelly area where the gravel is pretty small. It's a good area. And if you do find a shark's tooth, it's usually setting in relief above the rest of the soil.
It takes about 20 minutes before we start hitting on some teeth.
Let's see if I can spot that thing again. Right around in here.
That's a dead bee.
A dead bee, yeah, sure is. It's right around in here.
Oh, I see it.
Yeah, there you go. Look, two more.
I see it.
There, and another one here. Oh, Lindsay, another one. Four.
Someone must have lost a lot of teeth around here.
Something. I'm even more passionate about fossil hunting than I was when I was a kid, and I'm 59 years old now, so let's keep going.
John's enthusiasm is unflagging, but the rest of us end up lying on the sandy bank. A few hours later, we troop back to the car, weighed down by geodes, shark's teeth, and these 80-million-year-old fossilized oysters that go by the name of Exogyra ponderosa. My best find is a large piece of porcelain that John identifies as belonging to the tank of a mid-century toilet. When we get home, John's wife Yoshiko is making us dinner.
So, what are you making?
I'm cooking Korean noodles, spicy noodle.
What is that?
Shrimp and squid.
After dinner, John announces that it's time to visit the American Museum of God.
You need to sign in the guest list, the date, and your name.
John claims it's open to the public, but really, you would have to know him to get invited.
You have the Air and Space Museum, you have the Museum of Natural History, car museums, railroad museums, doll museums, but there is no museum recognizing the entity that created all this stuff in the first place. So I said, well, why don't you create a museum of God?
The museum is a small room that's packed floor to ceiling. John doesn't just collect, he creates. In one piece, he spelled out the word dang in shark's teeth. There's a huge fossil collage made of 40 years' worth of John's finds.
This collage is a collage of 1,600 separate invertebrate fossils. These invertebrate fossils are all arranged in the form of a dinosaur, a Diplodocus to be exact.
And so if you had a physical space, what kind of people do you imagine would come?
That would be the fun part, let me tell you. There would be religious people who would say, this isn't a museum of God. You know, where are the pictures of Jesus? You know, where's the crucifix? Well, what I would point out to them is, look, this is my museum of God. You can use anything on earth to illustrate any nature or aspect of God that you want. Every home could have a little museum of God. You maybe could just sit on their mantle, you know, and they could say, well, this is what I believe God to be, instead of, you know, taking your official church's doctrine and beating people over the head with it.
Before I visited John, science and creation seemed to be in opposition, simple as that. And intelligent design, that seemed like a deception, like creationism in camouflage. But John's love of the scientific record reinforces his love for God, and vice versa. It seems almost obvious. He wants people to bond over this sense of wonder.
If every home had a museum of God, or every community, they could use that as a calling card and say, hey, why don't you come over and have some coffee and see my museum of God.
So far, my museum of God, or whatever it might be, has only a piece of toilet tank. But it's a start.
Lindsay Patterson brought us that story. You can see some photos from the fossil hunting trip with John Halsey at studio360.org. When I start my own Museum of the Divine, I'm definitely going to add this to the collection. In 2009, archaeologists unearthed the earliest known musical instruments. Four flutes made of vulture bone and mammoth tusks were discovered in caves in southwestern Germany. They're almost 40,000 years old, and thanks to a reproduction of one, we know what they sounded like. This. Not quite Jethro Tull, but still pretty cool. According to the geneticist and anthropologist Spencer Wells, what we call arts and culture began just after we humans had barely escaped extinction.
And so we came back from these really rough conditions. And when we did, we had a new culture. We had the dawn of what's called the Late Stone Age in Africa, or the Upper Paleolithic outside of Africa. And this is when art makes its appearance and very finely crafted stone tools appear. We became behaviorally modern around that time. And that's probably what allowed us to survive. And so I think there is something inherent in human behavior that makes us want to create things, that makes us want to innovate. And I think it traces back to that tough time out on the African savannah. When the weather was very bad and we had to become smarter. And the way that we became smarter was by becoming innovation machines.
It began in Africa. Ga, 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 ga.
Coming up, we'll meet a scholar who's trying to connect the dots between evolution on the one hand and music and art on the other.
That imaginative ability, which is part of our big brain, which has terrific survival value, then becomes adapted into storytelling, into wit, into perhaps a sense of irony.
Plus, a short story from the possible future by the writer Lydia Millett. That's ahead in a minute in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360.
On today's show, we're talking about evolution. The philosophy professor Dennis Dutton provoked considerable debate a few years ago with his book, The Art Instinct. In that book, he argues that our taste in art is basically hardwired in our genes.
Yes, I think we might have started off with developing imagination, which is part of our big brain, which has terrific survival value. That in itself then becomes adapted into storytelling, into wit, where people are associating expressively with one another. It's a matter of being a more attractive and more interesting human being for everyone else in the tribe.
Has that itself kind of gone too far in trying to explain everything in terms of our selfish genes?
We don't need to be controlled by our genes in that way. I mean, it is quite possible, I think probable, that there is a Pleistocene adaptation that associates in our minds art with resources, with precious materials, with the gold frame, with being made out of very precious paints or whatever it is, and perhaps with being worth a lot of money. Now, if I'm right about that, it would mean that our children will, generation after generation, go through museums saying, "Daddy, how much did that one cost?" And we can still say, look, you shouldn't ask this, Jimmy. You should be asking, is it beautiful? And what makes it beautiful? I'm saying that if art and money are somehow linked in our minds, we don't have to go along with it.
Right.
But we should understand it.
What you're suggesting about art and all of the sort of most noble human endeavors is that much of it can be indeed swimming against the current of our animal predispositions.
That's right. That's right. And we'll better swim against the current if we know what the current is and where it's coming from.
Dennis Dutton, thank you very much.
Thank you, Kurt.
Dennis Dutton is the author of The Art Instinct. You can hear more of our conversation at studio360.org. It's a true story of murder, suicide, and the overthrow of a beloved leader, sort of modern dress Macbeth. The play is called Hominid, and 12 of its 14 actors portray chimpanzees. The bloody real-life incident took place at a scientific colony of chimps in the Netherlands. Frans de Waal, a leading primatologist, explains what happened.
It's a pretty brutal story of power and coalitions. First is a defeat of Jeroen, who is deposed by a younger male, Luit. And then later, Luit himself is deposed by Jeroen, who has recruited an even younger male, Nicky. And they together not only depose Luit, but they murder him.
Frans de Waal recounted the struggle between Jeroen and Luit in his book Chimpanzee Politics, and he advised Atlanta's out-of-hand theater as they adapted it for the stage.
My name's Adam Fristo. In the production Hominid, I'm playing Luit.
Facial expressions, gestures.
We came across a film that was made of the chimpanzees that are in the story.
Grooming.
It shows this idyllic island. They're birds. The chimpanzees celebrate. They have a really good time. So we began to look for a human parallel. And the thing that we came upon is the idle rich, the notion of people who have the leisure to not worry about food, to look beautiful. Both of those societies, this captive chimpanzee colony and this version of the idle rich, they're extremely well cared for.
Winter's chill grows tame and fair.
I'm Carolyn Cook. I play the role of Mama, which I also play in real life.
when the lights go up and characters first enter the stage, you're going to see beautiful people in tennis whites celebrating the beginning of spring, enjoying themselves, enjoying each other, hugging each other, jumping up and down.
Breathe the brightness of the day, hail the sweet breath of spring.
Because we've chosen to not have a tremendous amount of language in the show, everything pretty much has to be communicated physically. Simple physical dynamics change things, and how I can use physical tactics, whether by making myself smaller or making myself bigger or diverting my eyes away from someone, can dramatically change the way that we have an interaction.
If you watch humans, you can, of course, see the same thing, is that if the boss walks into the boardroom, he walks in differently than the lowest-ranking clerk. He opens the door wide and he has his chest out. And so there's all sorts of nonverbal signals of who is the boss.
One of the challenges is finding the balance between the amount of chimp behavior and the amount of human behavior, or what we're calling charm school.
The thing that I would fear is that you try to imitate chimpanzees, because then you have to put suits on and drag your knuckles and make strange sounds and all of this.
But if you don't show any of it at all, or don't incorporate any of it, then there's not really any mystery, and then we can't actually see into the parallels.
From now on, I'm going to ask you to use about an equal mix of chimp and charm school.
What I find in playing Mama is there's absolutely no difference between the internals of this chimp character, what she wants, what she needs, and the internals of a human old woman.
When we read the Duwal's account of chimpanzee politics, we were really struck by the same recognizable story. It turns out that these essentially human Shakespeare stories are actually just essentially ape.
Thanks to Philip Greatzer for that story. Humans have been tampering with genes for 10,000 years or so, ever since we started breeding plants. Unnatural selection, if you will. But that's a slow process that takes years and years. Modern genetic engineering is like sending evolution into warp speed. Some people think genetically modified crops is the way for us to end hunger. And others think that it's A, dangerous in ways we can't begin to know, and B, just sort of wrong. We asked the novelist Lydia Millett to run a worst-case fictional scenario, and she wrote this story, Alpha. It's read for us by Martha Plimpton.
She'd never flown in a helicopter. It lifted off in a breathless sweep, away from the concrete cliffs, and the weightless feeling made her clutch the armrests. She closed her eyes and pictured safety. She was back at the lab. She checked the centrifuge. She kidded with the techs. The craft banked, and she gasped and opened her eyes again. Beneath was the brown ocean with its grid of fish farms stretching out forever. The vibration was jarring. She focused on the destination, an island so small it had no name till the wonks at Global Ag found it on satellite and christened it Alpha. Before she set foot there, she'd irradiate herself with a kit in the back of the helicopter. They couldn't risk a particle on her clothing, a molecule from a passing bird. Alpha itself was protected, the whole tiny island tented in clear membranes.
"Hey," said the pilot into her headset, "don't be nervous. I have a perfect safety record. It's not you. Talk to me. Keep your mind off it. I've got clearance." She saw him tap his badge. "You're a scientist, right?" "Plant genetics. I do monocots, rice and corn." "Heard of them. Bit fuzzy on the details." "We want to grow them again. Grains and grass." "Grass?" "But you don't know. That's what this is. They found grass on Alpha." "Like grass that grows by itself?"
She glanced at him sidelong.
"They didn't tell you?"
"First time on the route. I get briefed at 1900.
Below, the ring of fish farms gave way to gray desalinization plants. They were miles from the edge of the continent. Calmer now, she recalled a painting, all blue, dotted with small white triangles. It was her father's. He'd said, "Once, honey, before the grasses went, we had a blue ocean.
The whole ocean was this deep, deep blue.
You want to give me a teaser then?
She sighed. Talking about it made her queasy.
The idea is, if we can take this grass, we might be able to splice the DNA to make it resistant. We could reseed, at least, that's the plan.
Reseed what?
The ground, everywhere. We could have fields. Bring back some of the other animals. Maybe the pollinators, bees, and butterflies. You could eat something besides synth protein and fish.
He looked amused.
Like what?
She fell silent. Ahead, the desal grid was turning to glittering fields of marine windmills, blades churning.
So the same guys who killed it are trying to bring it back?
Us.
It was for a war they did it?
It started in a war. They built a virus to destroy a flower. Poppies. It mutated like wild, and it turned out they couldn't control it. It was so fast.
Why did they want to destroy the poppies?
It's a long story.
So then what?
Then the extinctions. The food chain went...
I heard they used to eat these huge things with 10 stomachs. Freak me out.
Cows.
They gonna make us eat that crap if we get your grass back?
She laughed. Fat chance.
If you bring back grass, what will we do with the concrete?
The sun was lower now. Production grids thinning out till all she could see was black water and a spider web of cables.
There she is.
Alpha was a dot.
You want to fly over? Rare opportunity. It's authorized today.
Please. Yes. Over the low hill of Alpha's southern tip, she could see the tent rising like a clear glass cathedral, rippling in the breeze.
I mean, seriously. Those good things you said could happen. What are the chances?
She looked down and felt vertigo and the greatest thrill of her life. And she tried to hold on to it because she knew it would never come back. Right now, it was all possible. Beneath the undulating polymers was the tiny field, the last of all the fields. The sky was darkening, but she could still see green. It was paler than she'd imagined.
What are the chances?
Slim.
That's the great Martha Plimpton reading Lydia Millett's story Alpha, which was created just for this program. Millett's latest book is Mermaids in Paradise, and you can hear Martha Plimpton read another short story that Lydia Millett wrote for us at studio360.org. That's it for this week's show. Since we first aired this episode, Dennis Dutton has died. Special thanks to Rob Weisberg. And for more shows in our special series about science and creativity, visit studio360.org. We'll be back next week with a brand new show. In the meantime, you can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are at Studio 360 Show. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. The team here includes
Jenny Lawton,
Andrew Adam Newman,
Louis Mitchell,
Matt Frassica,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Krista Ripple,
Kestrel Wolgluth,
Joaquin Kotler,
Juliet Muller,
Emily Marinoff.
And I'm Kurt Anderson. Thank you very much for listening.
Studio 360's series on creativity and science is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information is online at sloan.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, in his new HBO series, Danny McBride plays a vice principal who's more out of control than his students.
When I become principal, I'm going to make sure you finally get the respect you due.
And that's what I'm talking about. You're going to get us a raise?
No, it's not going to be a raise. I'm just going to make sure that, you know, people don't look down upon you like they do now.
That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.